Princeton resident Alicia Bradshaw now knows what it sounds like when 30,000 gallons of liquid propane explodes a little more than half a mile from your home.
It was almost like an airplane was kind of hovering, because you could hear it. You could hear the rumble and then hear the roar, and then you just heard the explosion. And I went and opened the doors because it, you know, I could hear it over all the commotion in my house. I opened the door and just saw black smoke.
Bradshaw is a health services volunteer with the Red Cross, so she had already left the area to help with the incident when police went door-to-door at 60 to 70 homes and businesses as part of a mandatory evacuation. No injuries or fatalities were reported. The Red Cross opened a shelter at the Gibson County Fairgrounds for the displaced, who were later taken to a local hotel. Roads will remain closed and the evacuation in place until the fire is out. Fire officials expect it to burn anywhere from several hours to several days. Police have not said what led to the derailment. For WNIN News, I'm Isaiah Seibert.
Armed with military accounts of the 28th Infantry and Company K, images shot by military combat photographers and two local experts, our group begins tracing the steps of Chester Schultz in northern France. Richard Tucker runs a service called Tucker Tours, giving military history tours of the area around Sedan. Chris Sims retired after more than 40 years with the American Battlefield Monuments Commission, the organization which maintains American cemeteries and monuments in Europe from both world wars. We meet with Richard and Chris in the garden of our bed and breakfast in Sedan to go over maps of the troop movements that would help us trace the path of Chester Schultz.
They were fit men, weren't they?
I know. I mean, they were really moving along. And then that last day, with equipment, they were marching. Because it said by the end of the time they were relieved up there, they had gone 65 hours straight marching and going with only the rations they had on their back.
So no, and in the rain.
No food. And was it raining?
It was bad weather.
Okay.
Yeah.
See, I didn't know that. Wow.
We begin tracing Chester's steps in battle at the village of Shehari. It was there at sunrise, accounts record, that Company K took its first fire from German machine gunners. It was 7 a.m. on November 7th, 1918.
So from here on, it would have been real. You know, it would have been, you know, the first fire actually on them, and this push to go. But from now on, they know there's Germans anywhere. So it would have been real.
From Shehari, Chester and Company K marched up the west side of the Sedan Road, along the Bar River to the village of Chevauge. Film footage of that day shows American troops under fire as they run crouched over on the road leading into Chevauge. Company K, with Chester leading the first platoon, was ordered to the northwest of the village to attack a German machine gun position a short distance away on what was known as Hill 334. They stopped in the cover of the walled cemetery at Chevauge to plan their attack. It was about 7:30 in the morning.
The report from the 28th history says there was no artillery support and all resistance was overcome by sheer force of frontal attack. So it's just depending all on these guys with rifles in their hands. On the heights that now lay ahead, the Germans had prepared to make a desperate stand, for the loss of these hills meant the loss of Sedan.
Retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Tom Orlowski, president of the 1st Infantry Division Memorial Association, is a highly decorated infantry officer. We asked Lieutenant Colonel Orlowski how the soldiers may have reacted as they contemplated leaving the relative safety of the walled cemetery and moving directly into the fire of the German machine gun.
Some folks immediately fall apart. Most of them say, make it through this. And some others are just anxious to get in the fight. So it depends. There isn't one consistent through the soldiers' psyche that would be able to say, yeah, it's like this. Those privates and specialists and sergeants, they're sitting out there and they say, I hope that dumb bastard behind us doesn't tell us to get up and rush this machine gun, you know.
But the order to attack did come. Comparing photographs from 1918 with what is there now, a chilling truth emerges. The distance between the front gate of the Chevauche Cemetery and the likely site of the German machine gun is a little less than a mile. There is not now, nor was there a century ago, any cover, only a small dip in the terrain about halfway in between in an expanse of open farm fields.
As we stand here in the trees where the German machine guns were, is less than a mile away. They're down here at the cemetery looking up the bare ground toward those trees, and they're about to go right towards it.
Yes. I'm not sure I could have done it.
We asked Tom Orlovsky what Chester was facing as the leader of the 1st Platoon ordered to advance across the open field toward the machine gun.
In many cases, in order to get folks out of their foxholes, you jump up and you go first. But when you do that, you're not thinking about yourself, you're not thinking about anything. And pretty much most soldiers after the first battle feel pretty invincible. You know, oh hell, I'll live. Guy next to me might not have, but I will.
A quote attributed by some historians to General Pershing after the war went, "We won because the men were willing to pay the price." Based on historical accounts, their knowledge of military tactics, and a map, we go out to a certain spot in that open field with Richard Tucker and Chris Sims.
Well, it's also more likely they'd be near the road because they might be able to think they can dash to where the track is and there might be some, a ditch next to it or something. If they're walking halfway between them, they can't run anywhere.
No.
So I think they are nearish to the road.
I gotta pick a spot.
I think you're gonna be roughly right here.
I think we're probably right.
Yeah, I mean, like, they've seen the Americans. They've got an idea they're coming. They're too far away when they're down there.
Nancy Hastings is carrying a bouquet of flowers.
Once they get to here,
you know, they're not gonna run away. They'll go to ground. They just keep shooting at them until they've shot enough of them.
At the age of 26 years and 31 days, Sergeant Chester Schultz of Evansville, Indiana, former accountant at the Hercules Buggy Company, member of the church choir, beloved son, brother, and fiancé, died on that hillside along with seven other Americans. It was just after 8 o'clock in the morning on November 7th, 1918. Nancy Hastings gently places the bouquet of flowers on the stubble of the harvested wheat field.
I'm probably not a pretty crier.
Does that feel like an end
by putting that there?
A little bit. I mean, it's kind of been the search for where he was killed for them and for me for a long time. And I think we're pretty close. I mean, it I'm sure it's not the exact spot, but it's got to be fairly close.
Nancy hugs her sister Anne for a long moment and then steps back to snap images that will be quickly attached to messages for their families back in the U.S.
I think he died fairly quickly because of where he's buried. He didn't survive long enough to be taken back to a hospital at all, so I think it was a fairly quick death.
Chris Sims described what would have happened on the hillside shortly after the battle.
In Chester's case, 7 November, it was terrible weather. It was chilly, it was wet, and of course the burial parties with the winter coats and the heavy equipment would have slogged along as well to... And hastily in a muddy field to bury the dead.
Official accounts of the day indicate the rest of the company and other units were scattered and pinned down all day, unable to advance. They were relieved and finally got a hot meal and rest on the evening of November 7th. For the surviving members of 1st Platoon and Company K, the war was over.
The lawsuit accuses UE theater professor Scott Lenk of making numerous sexually suggestive and racist remarks to former student Alexis C., who's a black woman. The document alleges Lenk also repeatedly made sexually inappropriate comments in class. According to the document, Lenk would ask students if they were sleeping with one another and told the class he enjoyed oral sex and pornography with Asian women in it. The document also accuses Lenk of writing a role for C in one of his plays that she was supposed to perform nude. The document says the alleged harassment and the university's response made C fear for her safety. It says she withdrew from the university in February of this year. The lawsuit accuses the university of responding inadequately to allegations made against Lenk. Lindsay Cordes represents the plaintiff.
A reasonable response would have been immediately investigating this, putting some sort of safeguards or alternative accommodations in place.
The university said it doesn't comment on pending litigation, but reaffirmed its commitment to diversity. Lenk did not respond to requests to comment. In a statement, the university says theater professor Scott Lenk was fired last week after an investigation into complaints made against him. The university says that as a tenured professor, Lenk can choose to appeal the university's decision. A former student filed a lawsuit against Lenk, accusing him of multiple instances of racial and sexual harassment. The lawsuit also accused the university and two administrators of failing to respond adequately to those accusations. In court documents, Lenk and the university have denied any wrongdoing. The university says it's working with a Philadelphia law firm to prevent, quote, further occurrences of unacceptable behavior by any member of our university community.
Why is he upset and carrying on?
I don't know.
Okay, what's his name?
Vincent.
Vincent, all right.
He's in the kitchen. Be careful.
The theoretical impact of Albert Fink's crime on the court system in Indiana took a very real turn just after 5 o'clock in the evening last January. Evansville Police Department officers Jackie Smith and Herbert Adams responded to the call of a disturbed person at a home on South Grand Avenue.
Invite him into your house? Hun, hold on. Keep talking to me. Did you invite him in?
The officers didn't know yet that they were about to have a violent encounter with 47-year-old Vincent Bufkin, whose previous convictions include child molesting, battery with bodily waste, and several charges of resisting law enforcement. Smith's body cam recorded what happened when they found Bufkin in the kitchen.
Hello. Hi. How are you?
Doing good.
What's your name? Let me see your hands, man. Let me see your other hand.
They're right here.
Okay. But just keep, yeah, turn off the music, man.
No.
Huh?
Who are you?
Police.
Police officers.
What's your name?
Officer Smith, get stop reaching.
What's your name?
Officer Smith, stop. Get your hands out of your pockets.
Get
your hands out of your pockets, dude.
No, I'm not playing
stop.
That game.
Yeah, you are playing that game. Can you get in here more?
Playing that game, man?
Yeah. Drop the cigarette.
Oh, well, I can't go to blood.
Drop the cigarette.
Put out the cigarette.
Put out the cigarette.
What's his problem?
Put stop.
Body cam video shows Bufkin attacking Officer Adams, punching him, and trying to grab his service weapon. Officer Smith fired two shots, hitting Bufkin once in the shoulder before they could get him handcuffed and under control.
Stop. I'm dying. Stop. Okay.
Bufkin's case for the January incident is still pending. However, a 2014 conviction is on the list of 29 criminal cases in Vandenberg County where it is suspected Albert Fink may have falsified the mental evaluation. Novella Nedef is with Indiana University's McKinney School of Law. She says because Fink falsified another evaluation, it could be a bargaining chip for Bufkin if he's convicted of the January incident.
I think that it could be brought up at sentencing.
The issue is whether a different outcome in Bufkin's 2014 case could have prevented this latest incident.
Perhaps he could have gotten some services or some intervention that would have avoided him being in the situation that caused his most recent arrest.
Could he go free?
I don't see an avenue for that. Somebody would have to be a lot more creative than I am to come up with that one.
To To date, there have been no post-conviction filings related to the Fink evaluations beyond what we reported earlier. We'll continue to follow the story and provide updates as they become available.
Hola, en este episodio queremos hablar de identidad, y para eso we asked Amy to tell her story, a story of lost identity and mixed races. Amy has been identified as white most of her life, and fue solo in the last couple of years she learned that her heritage was, like she calls it, un fraude. Pero dejemos que ella cuente su historia. Soy Paola Marizán y esto es ¿Qué pasa Midwest?
¿Qué pasa Midwest?
¿Qué pasa Midwest?
¿Qué pasa Midwest?
Telling the stories of Latinos from the homeland to the heartland.
What's going on over here? I hear something.
So I went to see my grandfather in San Diego. I put my baby down for a nap, and the two of us sat under a homemade awning to talk. The breeze was warm, and there was something rustling behind his workbench.
I can't tell if it was down here or up there.
So, I want to be Mexican.
Good. I don't want to.
Is it okay with you if I am, though?
Yes, you bet. I'm not going to hold you for anything. I'm not going to be no Mexican for me.
My grandfather is from Mexicali, but he doesn't have any connection to the place or the culture, and that's on purpose.
I had a bad upbringing. Real bad.
His mother lived in the U.S. She worked at a factory. As a single mom, she sent money home to her family who looked after her two boys. Her family was not kind.
When I was a kid, I peed my bed. And so, see, I got beat for that. I couldn't help it. And then one of my uncles said, I'm going to take care of you. So he made a sign. He said, Mario wet his bed and put it around my neck, so I can have it in the school, so everybody can see me. And those are things that is not very pleasant to talk about. This is all I know about the Castellans. I mean, Castellans were terrible people for me, mm-hmm. to me. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to never go back. There's nothing that I like about Mexico, nothing.
So eventually, my grandfather immigrated to the U.S. and he joined the Navy. He says it was his salvation. It gave him a new family. The military family, of course, but also, like, a real new family. There was this Italian kid on base who took my grandfather home with him to Brooklyn on holidays and breaks, and his mother was especially kind to my grandfather.
And I was real happy. And I felt that at this particular time, I was reborn.
He took his rebirth all the way. My grandfather cooks Italian food. He sings Italian songs. And he even grows Italian varieties of tomatoes and herbs. He doesn't exactly go around telling people he's Italian outright. He just doesn't correct them if they make the assumption. And they do.
Can I tell you something?
Mm-hmm.
I thought that we were Italian for a while. Like, I really mm-hmm. believed that. And then when I found out that we weren't, then that for me was, it leaves me in kind of a weird spot. Do you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I'm not Italian. And I don't have that connection to Italian culture the way you do because of your experience with your friend. I don't have any of that. And I don't have any of Mexico. I don't have any of those things, you know? I want to learn Spanish. I want to learn to cook Mexican food. All of those things. Is that okay with you?
No.
Why not?
I just...
Well, you don't want me to speak Spanish and make tortillas and all this stuff?
Whatever you gotta do, gotta do. No, I'm not gonna hold you for that. No. No. If you have to do that, do it. Yeah, but you got your own other background. Don't forget it. Very need to have the white part of it.
So my Mexican grandpa is telling me to not forget my white heritage.
Very important. Okay. It's very, very, very important. Both things.
Los dos. Juntos.
Huh?
Los dos juntos, sí.
Whatever.
Lo que sea está bien.
The story about his rough childhood is real. Distant cousins have confirmed his claims that he was mistreated by the family. But there's also this other thing. My grandfather fell in love with this country via the military and then became a police officer. Places where whiteness really does mean something special, like he says. Whether he's conscious of it, it arguably behooved his efforts at assimilation to claim a European heritage rather than an indigenous American one.
Okay, well, what else do you think I need to know?
Just be a good person. Just be a good person. Don't be, I'm better than you and I'm better than that. No, you're not better than nobody else.
I'm better than some people.
Yeah. Well, now you're talking about something else.
You mean like culturally?
Yes. Okay. Yes, yes.
My daughter's nap is almost over and the rustling sound is back.
Sure sound like a red to me. I'm going to get my flashlight.
I'm not going to stay here for this. Am I?
Yeah, stay here.
Terrified.
I don't need his permission to learn about Mexican culture, but this conversation helps me let go of resentment I've carried about his cutting ties with Mexico. It's done. Moving forward, I have to learn about Mexican culture from other places and people. For some, I'm far too removed to claim my Latina heritage. Others accept my ambiguous identity, and some even help me learn things I wish I already knew. Like knowing by touch when the masa is ready to press for tortillas. But ultimately, I'm learning that my identity is not determined by them or by my grandfather. It's determined by me.
It's stuck. It's stuck in the... I told you. Oh, it's a lizard.
Mm-hmm.
There you are. We see you. Let's keep it in there till Bobby wakes up so she can see it.
Are you here for the march?
Yeah.
If you want to go ahead and go into the sanctuary, that's where we're going to be starting. Thank you.
Our next speaker today is Belle Townsend. She's a senior at Henderson County High School. She owns her own business. She's involved in the largest youth government program in the U.S. And today she actually left one of her conferences to come speak to you all today.
It was Wednesday, Chicken Ring Day. Notoriously the best day of the week in the cafeteria, we sat in a room of 400-plus students. It was February 21st, 1 week after Nicholas Cruz senselessly sentenced 17 children to death after pulling a fire alarm and shooting into the crowd. It was Wednesday, Chicken Ring Day. The fire alarm went off. It was lunch. We never had fire drills during lunch. Most of the students in the cafeteria did not get up. I know I didn't. My immediate reaction was not to flee fire, but to flee gunfire.
Okay, so I didn't come here today to be quiet, so we're not going to be quiet. How about that? Okay. So the first chants we have are going to be call and respond. So the first one we have is we call. I'm going to say that with a megahorn, and then you're going to say BS. So we're going to practice all these, okay? So we call.
BS.
We call.
BS.
Okay. The next one we have is no more silence and gun violence. So no more silence.
And gun violence.
No more
silence.
Before this march, much of the national debate about gun violence has come from older, mostly male speakers. But on this day, the students had the megaphone, the moral high ground, and plenty of support.
I did not just feel helpless because I might get hurt. I felt powerless because I thought I might die. In this cafeteria that I had eaten in approximately 650 times, I never thought my death would take place somewhere so familiar. But I guess those 17 kids in Parkland didn't think they would die in their school either. All of this went through my head in about 5 seconds, only to learn 30 seconds later that the fire alarm had malfunctioned. How devastating is it that our fire alarm, an alarm telling us to flee, somehow made us stagnant? The feeling of powerlessness I felt that day is one that made me empowered enough to speak to you today.
In a driving rain, young and old, they marched, seeming to wear their soggy clothes and shoes like badges of honor to the Four Freedoms Monument, which promised freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom from oppression, and freedom from fear.
Enough! Enough is 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 enough!
There are many theories behind why the Parkland, Florida mass shooting is the one prompting massive protests and lobbying efforts to change gun laws. It's possible that a new generation of American parents are beginning to play a role. I had an interesting conversation with one of the adult advisors of the Evansville March. Gina Garrett started talking about some of her own experiences in a way that was both chilling and enlightening.
So you actually came of age with Columbine.
I did, yeah. I was in government class and the day it happened, and it was April 20th. So we were in school, and the news, they put on the news at school, and it was a sea change moment. It was one of those things, like, we didn't know it was going to become an epidemic. It seemed like a one-time, you know, these two kids did this one bad thing, and then we thought, oh, well, that was, you know, it was terrible, it was scary. But no one ever thought at that moment in 10 years, in 15 years, we're still going to have this happening, you know, weekly, pretty much. If we'd known then, I think we would have been more scared than we are now. We should have been more scared, but nobody thought it was the beginning of something this, you know, entrenched. I think we really thought it was a crazy, one-time, scary thing, and it wasn't.
Something that intrigues me about that then, though, is it someone from your generation who had the experiences that you've had, is it more likely or less likely that they would get involved right now?
I do think coming from a place of, you know, remembering that day of when Columbine happened, I think it can sort of make you more empathetic to the kids of seeing, like, well, remember how scary that was? Imagine feeling like that every day. And that kind of gives you a little push towards, well, maybe we should do something. Maybe this isn't okay. So, yeah. And I never want to speak for anyone else, but I think more so than maybe people who are older, we do have a little bit of a personal stake in it just because we remember.
So, an entire generation of adults who have watched school shootings become more frequent and more deadly are moving into leadership roles, and they say they're ready for the hard work of effecting change.
There is nothing wrong with responsible gun ownership, but there is everything wrong with how we are currently operating. Stop this narrative before it is all our children know. Let them grow up in a society where they can be panicked when the fire alarm goes off because there really might be a fire. Let them grow up in a society where they know their voice matters and they don't just have to helplessly react. Let them grow up like the Sandy Hook students, Parkland students, and so many other students never got to. Let them grow up. Thank you.
Kay Cox and her husband weave through partitions and screens as they awaited a one-minute meeting and photo opportunity with the president.
And we went around the corner and it was like, wow, there he is. You know, it was just so cool.
The The private fundraiser at Old National Vince Plaza was the president's first stop in Evansville before a campaign rally at the Ford Center. The fundraiser benefited Republican Senate candidate Mike Braun. The cost to attend the fundraiser was between $1,000, which allowed a donor to hear a 20-minute speech from the president, and $25,000, which gave donors a private roundtable discussion with President Trump. Thursday night wasn't Jason Miner's first time paying to see the president, and while he didn't pay enough for a photo or a private discussion this time, it was worth the expense, he said.
Having Mike Braun elected is important to me, and it was important enough to donate and to be a part of the evening.
Cox, too, said the experience was worth every penny. And what will she do with the photo of her and the president?
I'm going to put it kind of someplace in my house.
For WNIN News, I'm Zach Evans.
It's the day after the 2018 midterm election. We begin our recap of local coverage with a change of control on the Vandenberg County Commission, where Democrats will hold the majority. John Gibson has details.
Democrat Jeff Hatfield defeated Republican Mike Duckworth by just 221 votes out of more than 58,000 ballots cast. Hatfield thanked his supporters at DeLegge's banquet room.
We always knew it was going to be a tough uphill climb. We worked every day, all day, never gave up, never stopped working hard.
Hatfield said one of the county's top priorities is expanding the crowded jail.
The first thing we have to do is sit down with the county council and work out an agreeable plan moving forward to expand the jail that will not increase people's taxes.
Hatfield also said he'll work to improve county roads.
Constantly we're looking for money in the budget to increase funding for roads. So that's a non-stop thing.
Hatfield will join fellow Democrat Ben Shoulders and Republican Cheryl Musgrave on the county commission in January. He'll fill the seat being vacated by Republican Bruce Ungertheim. For WNIN News, I'm John Gibson.
Mike Duckworth lost his bid for Vandenberg County Commissioner. He's not sure if he'll ask for a recount.
I'll have to review that with my folks and have them look at it, but, you know, it looks like everything's been counted, but who knows? We'll see.
He says he's looking forward to being a private citizen after he lost his race to Democrat Jeff Hatfield. Wayne Park is chairman of the Vandenberg County GOP. He called this year's voter turnout fantastic, and he thinks President Donald Trump helped push Republicans to the polls.
Now, on the flip side, if you're a Democrat, well, you may not like Donald Trump, so it's kind of inspired him there. So either way, he's played a role in that. And then we got some good candidates out there, too, that's helped generate interest.
Yesterday was the third time Nick Herman and Stan Levko vied for Vandenberg County prosecutor. WNIN's Isaiah Seibert reports Herman, the Republican incumbent, just scored another victory.
Nick.
Evansville Mayor Lloyd Winicky chants Herman's name as the prosecutor climbs on stage to give his victory speech at the GOP election results watch party.
You're coming. That's right. Take your time. Shake all the hands. You deserve to shake all the hands.
The incumbent thanked his supporters and staff in a brief speech. He says it feels great to win.
And it's been, a multi-month campaign and a lot of work and a lot of time, but you feel good when you see the results come in, particularly when you see this big of a turnout and this many people get out and vote.
He says there was a unique dynamic to this race because both he and Levko have been county prosecutor. Herman was first elected in 2010, and Levko was prosecutor for 20 years before that.
Each of us had a record that you could take a look at, and voters could be educated as to how we would both run the office. You don't see that a lot. You usually have an incumbent, a challenger that hasn't been in the office.
Herman received 53% of the vote. For WNIN News, I'm Isaiah Seibert.
As we said, former Vandenberg County prosecutor Stan Levko lost his bid to retake the office he lost 8 years ago. The Democrat said he probably will not run again.
I think it's exceptionally unlikely. No, I don't think so.
Levko fell to Republican incumbent Nick Herman, who also beat Levko 8 years ago. Political newcomer Edie Hardcastle fell short in her attempt to unseat Republican Indiana State Senator Jim Toms, but Hardcastle said she was happy with her campaign.
You know, we did everything that we could to, do every strategy that we had in our toolbox. And so we were able to execute all that, and we're happy with how we ran our campaign.
Hardcastle couldn't say whether she would try another political race in the future. She lost to Toms by about 20 percentage points. A number of state representatives from the Evansville area held on to their seats. Republican Wendy McNamara defeated Democratic challenger Steve Foles, and State Representative Ron Bacon won another two-year term at the State House, beating Democrat John Hurley. Some incumbent state representatives were unopposed, including Democrat Ryan Hatfield and Republican Holly Sullivan. This is WNIN News.
Certainly the building blocks have always been here, and we've successfully invented and reinvented ourselves many times over history.
Drew Perrinen is a local entrepreneur and champion of innovation, and he says Evansville is in a natural cycle.
The difference right now is the speed with which things are changing.
You may have noticed, looking at Franklin Street or Haney's Corner, Evansville's urban core has transformed in the past 10 years. And now we have the Franklin Street Bazaar and First Fridays and, behind the scenes, a mass of entrepreneurs working on everything from nonprofit grants to software as a service to innovative ways of making things. As a new generation with distinct life experiences and values is rising, we're improving our collective self-image and getting excited about collaboration. It's a perfect storm, decades in the making. Looking to the future, Perrinen cites research he found in Enrico Moretti's The New Geography of Jobs. According to Moretti, there are three types of communities. The ones that have chosen to remain stagnant, the ones ready to adapt and eager to innovate, and then there are the ones in the middle, those that could go either way.
So I think that, you know, right now Evansville is somewhat in that middle strata, but we clearly have made a choice as a community to move towards that innovation community. There is a critical mass of collaboration here. There's a critical mass of people that know the direction we need to go.
And the key to staying on the rise is listening to those people. This is former Mayor Jonathan Weinzapfel.
Frankly, we're always one election away from having a leader that doesn't look at the world that way, that wants to look backwards instead of forwards. So there's a lot of momentum, but unless people work at it, nurture it, encourage it, it won't continue.
That means we all need to vote. But before we vote, we need to research. This is Perrinen again.
And we have to realize we are not competing against one another. We're not competing against different counties. We're not competing against different states. We're competing on a global platform now. And we have to get past parochialism and provincialism. We have to be looking at ourselves as a way that we are globally relevant in what we do.
So regardless of neighborhood or city or region, we need to work together. Ross Chapman is helping us do just that by making connections between the churches of Evansville and the city of Evansville.
Yeah, if you're worried or concerned, I think one of the cool things about Evansville is you can get involved and do something. You know, and I think there's an atmosphere or spirit in the city right now that would be very open to that, be willing to hear you say, okay, I didn't understand, and thanks for making me aware and helping me understand your perspective, and, you know, what can we do to work towards making that different?
That means we need to speak up in a constructive way. We need to tell our business, arts, and social leaders what is bothering us so that we can adapt and innovate. Tim Piazza began doing that back in the 90s, and now he runs Evansville Coffee Company.
So as a community, we want to be more flexible and more adaptable and have the opportunities in place for a business to come in and innovate and thrive and attract employees and grow and become part of the community.
Good afternoon. This is WNIN News. I'm Steve Berger. There is a flash flood warning for parts of southwest Indiana until 6:45 this evening. That's behind a line of storms that made its way through the area and continues to affect some parts of southwest Indiana At this time, Western Kentucky not getting that rain yet, but it is headed your direction. So rest assured, there could be more watches and warnings issued before this storm system gets passed. A Vandenberg County magistrate has resigned following an investigation of alleged misconduct. WNIN's John Gibson has the story.
Magistrate Jeffrey Shoulders stepped down following the probe by the Indiana Commission on Judicial Qualifications. The 7-member commission concluded Shoulders took part in, quote, inappropriate relationships with court employees and attorneys during court hours and on court property, end of quote. In addition to resigning, Shoulders agreed not to seek nor accept any judicial office in the future. In the agreement, the commission said it stopped the investigation with Shoulders' resignation, but would reopen the probe if he holds any judicial position at any time. The commission investigates alleged ethical misconduct by judges and magistrates. It has the power to file public formal disciplinary charges. The Indiana Supreme Court also allows the commission to accept an agreement with a judicial officer who is facing formal charges. For WNIN News, I'm John Gibson.
75 decibels. That's the new noise limit for residential areas in Evansville. WNIN's Isaiah Seibert has that story.
There be 9 ayes, 0 nays. Ordinance G2018-11 is hereby declared adopted.
Some in the audience clapped after city council members voted unanimously for the ordinance, which sets a cap for noise that travels past a neighboring property line. Lawn equipment, garbage trucks, and dogs and cats are largely exempt. The vote came after a lengthy session of public comments and deliberation among the council. Supporters of the ordinance cited the health risks of noise pollution. Opponents were concerned about the impact on businesses and argued the ordinance would detract from the city's efforts to attract young people. The old ordinance called for the city's Environmental Protection Agency to enforce noise limits, an arrangement city EPA Director Jacob Keating said was unusual.
There's only one other Environmental Protection Agency at the city level in the state, but yet still their noise ordinance falls under the police department, where 98%, something close to all, of the noise ordinances fall.
The new ordinance gives police the ability to enforce. For WNIN News, I'm Isaiah Seibert.
The Tri-State Alliance hosted the annual Evansville Pride Picnic this past Sunday in celebration of Pride Month. As WNIN's Emily Miles reports, organizers and attendees flowed in and out of the Burdett Park Shelter House, learning and giving and being themselves.
This is local musician Angel Rhodes. She's singing an impromptu song with Benny Jenkins in a shelter house at the Tri-State Alliance's 39th Pride Picnic. This was her second year performing at the celebration.
It's very easy to get so wrapped up in our lives and like you don't really know that there's people in the community that can help you and be there for you. And I feel like events like this help that happen, bringing the kids out and having them experience it. And it's all about the community and everybody sticking together and know that you're not alone. You know, we got your back.
A crowd listens inside, and one just as large mingles outside. There's Mr. Gay Evansville, Liam Douglas, who does drag as Jaden Licious.
I do it for the kids, and I do it because I know when I was younger I didn't have any place to come for support, and so I'm giving away backpacks today for kids with supplies and stuff in it and personal hygiene items.
And then there's Kurt Etheridge, who co-facilitates the transgender support group.
There are many situations in which trans individuals are asked to defend who they are or explain who they are, but hopefully at an event like Pride, you can just be yourself and have fun with your friends.
And then there's Derek Wedding, who's wearing a shirt that says,
"Proud dad of a transgender child." We don't have very many trans people that are visible to us in our community, so come over here, there are more, and she gets to be with more people that are just like her and understand what she's going through, so that helps her a lot.
And there are so many more, representing the diversity of the area LGBTQ+ community and allies.
I'm Sean
Katie
Q.
Katie Marmino, Harley. August Lashley.
I'm Kim.
Devin
Galloway, Director of
Community Outreach and
Development
for Brentwood Springs.
One thing they all have in common is their dedication to the upcoming generation. They recognize the community, they give kids tools to learn and grow, they provide a place free of questions and full of support. They help their children see possibility in others, and some, like Angel Rhodes, work to raise allies. She asked her mom to bring her great-niece and nephew to the picnic.
You need to teach open-mindedness, like, young, so that way it doesn't create a problem later.
So that the spirit of the TSA Pride Picnic can continue to expand beyond the shelter house and beyond June. For WNIN News, I'm Emily Miles.
On to Main Street this week, join David James as he chats with local pawnbroker and comedian Rachel Goldman. Her family has been in business in downtown Evansville for more than a century, and the location is right in the heart of the action with the medical school just steps away.
Now, your location, I know you're going to be really close to the new medical complex, the IU Med School and everything. A lot going on in your neighborhood there.
It's very cool to see all the development take place. I look forward to making loans to every single med school student who comes to the Evansville campus.
Well, speaking of that, when I went to the pawn shop a few days ago, I see the usual things you see in a pawn shop. Mm-hmm. You got guitars everywhere. You got rifles and watches, jewelry, and those are the usual things you see. Are there any other oddities that maybe you have tucked away that we should know about?
You know, we actually very proudly display the oddities, so there's really nothing tucked away. But some of the coolest things aren't for sale. So we have, one of the very first oscillating fans that we have on display at the store. And I'm sorry to say that even as something not for sale, we get more offers on that.
Figures.
Than a huge amount of other things in the store. We have a Nightingale guitar, which was originally manufactured in Evansville. That's an antique. Comes with a patented second sound hole, which one would hope would make it sound better. It does not. It is not a great guitar, but it is fun to have.
Oh, my goodness. So I guess there's probably a story behind every pawn, isn't there?
I suppose there is, yeah.
Did people ever tell you about why they're doing something, or they just kind of go in there and do their business and hit the road?
Yeah, people, just conduct their business. There is the phrase, I think, as cold as a pawnbroker's heart. It's not necessarily like that. I'd like to think we don't earn that reputation. A lot more interested. There are some people who, as long as my family has been in business, their family have been customers. And that's always really special to see. So it's not necessarily the story of the object. It's wonderful to appreciate this historic relationship with these other families. It's always the people. It's not the stuff, it's the people.
And when Rachel isn't dealing with customers, she's on the Comedy Club circuit. 2 Main Street airs Thursdays at noon, Saturdays at 11, and you can hear all the past interviews by going to the WNIN app. This is WNIN News. I'm Steve Berger.